Well, supporters of the Pathway Promise bond have been celebrating. Voters in the Lansing School District yesterday approved the proposal with 61% of the vote. Officials say that 20-year millage renewal will bring in $120 million to renovate more than two dozen school buildings in the district. Lansing Board of Education President Peter Spadafore wrote on his Facebook page that the Pathway Promise is a vision for the future of this district and a commitment to a better tomorrow. We spoke with a critic of the measure late last night after it was obvious it would pass. Charles Riley lives in DeWitt Township.
I think they did more harm with this than good, because people are going to realize once they start seeing the tax bills, and if they actually make public this purchase of the bond, how costly this is actually going to be to the taxpayer.
Now, under the proposal, the Pat and Gill Academy will become the new Lansing Eastern High School with more than $13 million in improvements. The current Eastern High School building has been sold to Sparrow Health System for nearly $2.5 million. It's Current State here on WKAR. Many thanks for joining us today. President Obama is visiting Flint today to see firsthand the effects of lead contamination in the city's drinking water. The president is vowing more federal aid for residents, and he says the government will be there for them in the long term. Congressman Dan Kildee is a Democrat from Flint. He's traveling with the president today. Recently, Mr. Kildee sponsored legislation that would lower the threshold for lead-tainted water that would require the federal government to step in. I spoke with Mr. Kildee on his cell phone earlier today before he flew home here to Michigan aboard Air Force One. First, I asked him for more on what he thinks the purpose of President Obama's visit is.
Well, hopefully it's to bring more attention to this case. I mean, a lot of us have been concerned that the spotlight would fade, and our argument for more help for Flint, really a robust response equal to the crisis, would somehow elude us. Having the President of the United States come to Flint will obviously have a big impact on that. I think further, though, I mean, it's a chance for him to hear directly from the people of my community and understand in more real terms the human dimension of this tragedy. So I'm very happy that the president is coming. Obviously, I hope that it translates into some real help for the people of Flint.
Do you know what he will see or who he will meet with?
Well, I know he will meet with some of the families affected by the crisis. He'll meet with the agencies that are coordinating the response on the ground in Flint, federal agencies. My understanding is, along with myself and Senator Stabenow and maybe other members of Congress, that the governor may join that particular meeting. I think that would be a step in the right direction. He'll address a larger crowd of people from the area at Northwestern High School in the afternoon.
Governor Snyder did ask for a face-to-face with President Obama and with Mayor Weaver. Do you know if that's been granted then?
I don't know what form the meeting will take, but it's my understanding that the governor will be there and that he'll participate in perhaps greeting the president at the airport and also in the briefing. That's not confirmed, but that's my understanding.
Well, is there a specific action, an executive action, that President Obama might announce while he's here? Would such a thing surprise you?
I don't know that he'll announce anything specifically because, you know, for the last several months he has been pushing the various departments, his cabinet secretaries, to find resources within existing programs to help Flint. And they've done that. I mean, they've come up with tens and tens of millions of dollars of resources. I suspect that the real impact would be to get the Michigan state government and the Congress of the United States to stop playing politics with this and just get about the business of getting the problem fixed. We can worry about, you know, either simultaneously or later on, all the questions about how this happened, who did what, how we can prevent it again. But, you know, when a community is in crisis, you fix the problem. And I think that's really the message that the president will have. Let's get this fixed, and we can work on the other issues that we obviously have to take up.
How exactly is politics getting in the way of that effort?
Well, when most of the focus seems to be blame shifting, whether it's within the state government or, frankly, some of the Republicans that I've been dealing with in Congress. I don't mean to make this partisan, because some of my Republican colleagues have been very helpful. But the Republican chairman of the Oversight Committee, for example, who excoriated the EPA, said it was their fault. The very next day, when asked if that meant that the federal government has a responsibility to fix it, he said, no, this was a state-created problem. And so, I mean, that kind of double talk is just politics, and it has no place when a community is in crisis.
We're talking with Congressman Dan Kildee. He's the Democrat representing Michigan's 5th District, which includes the city of Flint. He's will be in Flint today with President Obama, who's coming to see the effects of the lead crisis firsthand. You introduced legislation last week that would create tougher standards for lead in drinking water. Your bill would, and I'll quote here, reduce the threshold amount of lead found in drinking water before federal action is required. It would lower it from 15 parts per billion to 5. There appears to be some degree of consensus over just such a move. Can you describe the response to your bill so far?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of concern about it. And this is one of those areas where, you know, people talk about all of our differences. Governor Snyder and I agree. He proposed a higher standard for the state of Michigan. I think it should be even higher, and it should be nationwide. So we agree that there would be a higher standard. The concern that I've heard isn't so much that the standard is wrong, but whether or not this country has the will to make the investments to improve water systems so that the standard can be met. And, of course, that's why I proposed a phase-in over 10 years to go from 15 parts per billion down to 5. If we can't figure out in the next decade that we have better get about the business of spending money to improve these 100-year-old water systems that are falling apart, then, of course, we're really not living up to our obligation to the people that we work for.
About a week ago, Senators Barbara Boxer, the California Democrat, and James Inhofe, the Oklahoma Republican, introduced the Water Resources Development Act of 2016. I understand it includes some amount of federal assistance for Flint residents. Can you tell us, do you know about that bill and what it would do?
I do, and it's a regular program. It's called Water Resources Development Act. We call it WRDA. It is a program that provides support for states and communities working on the broad range of issues related to water management. The language that we have been pushing in the Senate that Senator Mike Lee from Utah effectively blocked now has been included in that proposed reauthorization of WRDA, of the Water Resources Development Act. If that goes through the Senate, then it's going to be up to the House as to whether they take it up, we take it up, and whether or not it includes that language. So it's a step in the right direction for sure. And our two senators, Senator Stabenow and Peters, deserve great credit for having accomplished that. But we've got some distance yet to travel before we can actually count on that becoming law.
It kind of begs the question, how would you describe the House of Representatives' broader attitude about help for Flint?
Well, you know, there's a lot of sympathy, there's a lot of concern, almost universal sympathy from the people and what they're going through. Nothing close to universal support for the solution. I've spoken to Speaker Ryan about this. I don't want to try to quote him directly, but, you know, he has not made any firm commitment that the House will take up aid for Flint. So, you know, we've got a battle to fight, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that there are members in the House and the Senate, for that matter, that just believe the federal government ought not be involved in any of this stuff. There are people who voted against relief for the hurricane victims of Hurricane Sandy, where the entire eastern seaboard was wiped out, a natural disaster. And there are these ideologues that somehow believe that that's a state and local government responsibility. You know, that's just ridiculous. There are times when a crisis is so great that we come together and we act through our federal government. And whether it's a hurricane on the East Coast, or in this case, a city of 100,000 people with undrinkable water. We're all Americans, and we ought to pitch in together once in a while. And I think they're wrong, and hopefully we can overcome those voices.
Governor Snyder was in Flint on Monday and drank city water, and will, before he's through, drink Flint water for 30 days, and he encouraged others to do the same. What do you think of that gesture?
Well, it's a gesture. I mean, honestly, I can't fault him for drinking Flint water. But, my gosh, a public relations, you know, stunt or effort is just such a small step when you think about all the big things that they're not doing to get the help that Flint actually needs so that even every citizen can trust that the water they're drinking is safe. It's obvious that the governor's first response when this whole crisis began was to hire two public relations firms. And he's been listening to their advice, where he should have been hiring hundreds of public health nurses to help the people in Flint. And I can't be too critical, because obviously we want to have people feel like the government is in sympathy with them. But I'm exhausted by the political and public relations effort that the governor has launched. It's just tiring. We need real help, and we don't need more photo ops.
The governor's office announced yesterday that children and adults up to age 21 and pregnant women who were served by Flint's water system within the past 2 years should be eligible for Medicaid health coverage beginning on Monday, May 9th. That coverage would be available to that demographic if they have income levels up to 400% of the federal poverty level. Any particular response to that development?
Well, I think it's really interesting that the governor's talking about it, because it was the president of the United States that did that. It was announced several weeks ago that the United States government, the Sylvia Burwell, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, made that happen. It requires 1% match from the state government, 99% from the federal government. We put the money up. And the governor, rather than coming up with state resources, chooses to step in front of the camera and take credit for something that President Obama did. And then in the same breath, he criticizes the federal government for not doing enough. You know, it's a public relations game show that he's putting on. And it's really, I mean, I'm really happy that the Medicaid expansion is going through, and that the state government, after weeks and weeks and weeks of not taking action, finally decided to put up their 1% match. But my gosh, to stand up and take credit for it is just a little bit too much for me to take.
Let's turn to politics here. On the morning after Bernie Sanders wins the Indiana primary here, in an editorial yesterday, the New York Times said that assuming Hillary Clinton is the Democratic candidate, and you are a supporter of Mrs. Clinton, the Times said that to truly unify the party, she and party leaders must work to incorporate Mr. Sanders and what he stands for in the party's approach to the general election. Generally, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that Senator Sanders, with whom I've worked on trade issues, for example, has brought a very important voice to the national debate. And these campaigns are not just about selecting a single candidate, but for the nation to have a conversation. He has contributed greatly to that conversation, especially around the need for the reform of our political system. And I hope there is a very strong plank in our platform that works to get money out of the political process. And we can thank Bernie Sanders for making that such an important part of his campaign.
If you were in a position to advise Senator Sanders, though, as a Clinton supporter, would you advise him to get out of the race?
Well, that's a decision he'll have to make. What I would advise is that when the time comes that he make, assuming that Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton is the nominee, which I think is most of the conventional wisdom, I believe she will be, that he make it clear that he will be supporting and robustly supporting her candidacy, and asking all of those people who have come to politics through the Bernie Sanders campaign to join him. That's my hope.
Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And coming up on Current State, the mission of the Michigan College Access Network is to increase college readiness, participation, and completion for Michigan's high school students. We'll speak with MCAN's founder, Brandy Johnson, and Waverly High School counselor, Ashley Justice, coming up on Current State. After graduating from East Lansing High School back in 1975, Timothy Busfield went on to a successful career in the movies, television, and directing. It's included appearances in more than 30 TV movies and feature films, including the memorable 1989 fantasy Field of Dreams.
You build a baseball field in the middle of nowhere, and you sit here and you stare at nothing.
He's been a regular or recurring character on 14 TV series, including West Wing and 30-something, for which he won an Emmy, and has directed more than 90 television episodes. He's also appeared in over 50 plays. After years living in California, Busfield moved back to Michigan in 2010. He was joined by his spouse, actress Melissa Gilbert, in 2013. Today, he and Gilbert, who is a Democratic candidate for the 8th Congressional District, live in Brighton. Recently, Tim Busfield returned to East Lansing to spend the day at MSU's College of Communication Arts and Sciences. He spent some time talking with students and staff about the future of storytelling. I first asked him how he feels storytelling is changing.
Well, I mean, when your original storytelling is around the campfire, there was no electronics to it at all. It was just, you know, how did you kill the woolly mammoth, and here's how we did it, and here's how we got the food we're eating. And story evolved in for millennia. We're without any electricity attached to it. And about 100 years ago or so, we started making moving pictures and needing a lot of electricity and a lot of light to make an impression on very slow film. The film, maybe 50 ASA. I don't know if you remember. You're old enough to realize it. Remember that when we had the old Instamatic cameras, and they used to be, it went to 200, and then all of a sudden it went to 400, and we could shoot inside with a new Instamatic. Now that number is about 300,000 on a lot of the computers. They actually shoot better at night than your eye can see. That's how sophisticated they've become. So we've now gone back to the ability to tell stories without needing light, without needing big, huge lights, and then lots of equipment to get rid of the light. Well, now you don't need that. So the ability for a filmmaker to get their stuff out is similar to what you're seeing with the podcast world. So with the new media that we have out there, the desire or need for pushing a boulder uphill to find the equipment necessary to deliver the product is not there anymore.
It's technologically driven change. Is that your focus?
I think that technologically, yes, and how that influences all of the other. You've seen now people with their phones are making YouTube videos, telling shorter stories, finding a way to connect with an audience. And it's not as much a country club environment on who gets there. You used to need to have money or who you knew or how you knew people to get to be able to tell a story. And now you can tell a story on your own and put it up on YouTube and have 10 million people.
But it's affecting some media more than others. I know you've appeared on stage many times, more than 50 times from what I learned. Is storytelling going to change less when it comes to the theater since there's less technology involved?
I think that, to me, that's why I think theater in the round. I think you see theater is dying for a number of reasons. Proscenium theater particularly isn't accessible to the audience anymore because they're used to seeing performances over someone's shoulder, over someone's back. That the distance traveled to a proscenium theater may not necessarily be the best environment for making something feel real. With the ability of putting theater in the round, I think theater adapting to more cinematic values. When you're on somebody's back in a theater situation, you'll still listen. I went down to LCC and saw a play the other night that our stepson is in, and they had the Black Box Theater, which I'd performed in a few years ago, all the way out in a severe thrust. And the director hated it because he had to figure out how to block for that configuration. The audience loved it because they were so intimate. So storytelling has to adjust. And I think that in the future, what we're going to see are storytellers that are delivering docu-fiction feeling stories that the audience feel affected by and that they want to change when they see, which was ultimately the goal of feature films. You know, reality TV has revealed our writing in TV to not be too awfully good.
You've anticipated my next question. I was just going to say, regarding storytelling, how big a factor has reality TV been?
Reality TV's been you can look at it as a negative, or you can look at it as a positive. I tend to look at everything as a positive, but you know, the negative aspect of reality TV, for what I have been trained to do, is I take responsibility, as should everybody in our business, that we were not real enough in our writing or our directing or our acting for the audience to feel like they were. To get involved and to get emotionally involved. They find it easier to get emotionally involved with non-scripted emotional storylines that are being improvised, where people and non-actors are expressing their opinions with their own voice. The hardest thing to do for any professional actor, and the dividing line between the amateur and the professional, is the ability to deliver scripted dialogue believably and with a rhythm which is attractive to the audience. And it's a very difficult thing for actors to do. In reality TV, everybody's using their own dialogue, so everybody sounds more real and the audience tends to believe it more. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be telling fiction, narrative stories. We might just need to loosen up our attachment to the dialogue and try to find a more real way and a more effective way of getting that out.
We're talking with actor Tim Busfield, who's spending the day back here at Michigan State in East Lansing. Have you had chances to hear what's on students' minds today? I mean, what's your impression of college-age students, younger people generally, as far as what kind of stories they respond to?
Well, I haven't really talked to them necessarily about what stories they're responding to.
But they're part of this reality TV generation, I guess,
right,
you could
right.
say. So
I think they want it to feel real. I think that for them to relate, they want it to feel real. That world is blown to them of just fiction. They're not just going to tune in to an episode of network television that's overwritten and underplayed and accept it. They'd rather click off and go purchase something that moves them off their phone. So they're moving rapidly away from scripted, longer format.
Overwritten and underplayed. That's an interesting combination.
Yeah, it is. It's what a lot of TV is.
Well, underplayed.
You want to underplay overwriting. It's a smart choice. The better actors and what you're going to see, the more professional actors are going to look at an overwritten scene, and they're going to realize the only way to navigate it is to underplay it. You can't play on the writing. If the writing is, I'm very upset and mad and hurt, and I'm crying because you've broke my heart, most actors on TV, you wouldn't be able to squeeze a tear out of them because they're saying how much they feel versus, you know, Denzel Washington and Glory getting whipped and the teardrop falls down his face with no dialogue and he gets an Academy Award and the audience is moved to tears. It's just the climate we're in television, particularly where the development is all about the writing and overwriting. It's the same TV we've had for years. It's just more exposed with reality TV.
East Lansing native Tim Busfield there during a recent visit to Michigan State University. Quick question for you. Who of you would rather be driving M22 right now as opposed to where you are? Everybody, just as I thought. Grand Rapids historians Christine Byron and Tom Wilson coming up. They speak with WKAR's Peter Wharf about their book, Vintage Views Along Scenic M22. That and more after the break. Current State, three times daily on WKAR, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, and every weekday at noon on AM 870. WKAR, always at WKAR.org. A college degree has become increasingly important in today's job market, but many students feel higher education is out of their reach. The mission of the Michigan College Access Network is to increase college readiness, participation, and completion, particularly among low-income students, first-generation college students, and students of color. Joining us today for Neighbors in Action, Brandy Johnson, founder and executive director of MCAN. Welcome back, Brandy.
Thank you.
And Ashley Justice is a college counselor at Waverly High School. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you.
Brandy, talk to us about founding this group. You obviously saw a need and took action. I'm impressed just to hear about that and learn that. What were you seeing out there that triggered this?
What I was seeing was a little bit of chaos in the college access world in Michigan. There were a lot of isolated, really well-meaning college access programs in Michigan, but really taken one at a time would never give us the needle-moving progress that we needed to see in the state. I wanted to organize a more cohesive movement to get people from all sectors, K-12, higher ed, business, philanthropy, the nonprofit sector, and government working together collaboratively to support more students pursuing post-secondary education and succeeding once they get there.
MCAN operates as an intermediary then. Is it fair to describe what you do that way?
That's exactly right. Most of our work is actually in community investment. We provide grants and support directly to communities that are working strategically to help more of their students go to college.
Just go a little bit deeper with us. How exactly do you do that? How do you operate?
So primarily, we help communities organize coalitions around college access, gathering local high-level leaders to set a strategic vision and goal, and then work smart to get closer to those goals. We offer provide professional development to school counselors. We host statewide campaigns like College Application Week, where this year we challenged 300 high schools to help every single one of their students, their seniors, complete a college application by the end of October. We build new partnerships between organizations, and we really attract philanthropy from within the state to the cause of college access.
Ashley, you were placed at Waverly High School as part of that an Advise Michigan program. Describe the type of counseling that you're doing there.
So I'm with the Michigan State College Advising Corps, and we're very, very similar with Advise Michigan. We work closely with them. My role in the high school is to work with high school students, particularly juniors and seniors, and help them figure out what's next after high school. And we operate very closely with programs like MCAN, the College Advising Corps, to help us be successful in what we do.
Now, Brandy referred to particular goal setting. Do you set goals here as far as your work goes? I mean, do you think in terms of percentages of the kids at Waverly High School who will at least apply to attend college? Mm-hmm. Do you think of it in those terms?
I definitely look at the numbers to see how I'm doing. This is the first time that an advisor has been in the high school, so the needle moving has been a little slower, but this year has definitely been a lot easier in the second year in the program. We do set a goal as my supervisor at MSU, we work together to set a goal. We have a meeting with 100% of our seniors by the end of the year, which I am very close to meeting, getting 70% of our students to fill out the FAFSA, getting 40% parent participation rate. And I'm working very closely with those numbers, and I'm almost there.
And tell me, what is the conversation like when you meet with a high school junior or senior who says, yeah, I'm just not thinking about college? What kind of conversation do you have with them?
So I work to find out why. I mean, there's a lot of news right now saying, you know, students are leaving college with $100,000 in debt, which we know people in higher ed know that that's not necessarily the case for most students. There are very small, minor cases like that. So I work with students to help them. If cost is a concern, I talk to them about, you know, well, we can apply for scholarships. There's all these grants available in Michigan that they can do.
Is that common? Do you hear that a lot?
Yes. So we actually...
I don't want to go into debt like that. People have that perception. Yeah,
absolutely. So there are tons of options for grants in the state of Michigan, especially for our students who've been on Medicaid, students who are on free or reduced lunch. There's things like the Pell Grant. There's a tuition incentive program. So college can be very affordable for our students. And then we also talk about what is responsible debt. So making sure... I mean, right now it is very hard to not leave college without debt, but there's a difference of walking out of college with $100,000 in debt or $15,000 in debt.
Manageable debt.
Yeah, yeah. Something that, and I talked to them about, you know, you can't pay for a car outright, right? You have to take out a loan, and that car is going to give you more opportunities. It's going to be able to help you drive to work, going to be able to help you drive to get your groceries and things like that. So sometimes it's a necessity in order to help you be successful, and that's what college is.
I'm speaking with Ashley Justice, a college counselor at Waverly High School here just adjacent to Lansing, and Brandi Johnson, founder and executive director of the Michigan College Access Network. Brandi, how do you view the obstacles that young people are apt to encounter when they think about college and maybe are leaning toward not attending college?
It's definitely a complicated issue, but I think we as adults need to make sure students have as low as possible barriers preventing them from pursuing post-secondary. So certainly there's the aspiration and the social capital. Students need to aspire to pursue post-secondary education and be confident that they are college material, that they belong there, that they can do it, and to Ashley's point, that it's worth it. Students also need academic preparation, which is a barrier. Students that go into college immediately into remedial, non-credit-bearing coursework are, you know, incredibly, very few of those students ever complete. And then students need navigation support, which is exactly what Ashley and her peers at the MSU College Advising Corps do. They hold the hand of every senior to help them navigate the really complicated and bureaucratic process of pursuing post-secondary. And then lastly, the most cited barrier amongst both students and their parents is affordability, which absolutely we need to work at a policy level to make college more affordable. But we also need to make sure that perceived affordability isn't a barrier in and of itself, where low-income students assume college is way out of their reach, that it's so expensive that they price themselves out of the market before they have a chance to sit down with someone like Ashley to complete the FAFSA, find out they qualify for a Pell Grant, which covers more than the cost of tuition at Lansing Community College, for example. So we need to help bring down the costs of college, and that's a policy conversation that we need to have with the legislature and the governor's office, as well as our universities and colleges. But at the same time, we need to make sure that students understand that college is an investment, and it's one the best investment that they can make.
Are there obstacles that are particular to Michigan that you're aware of that other states that are not as significant in other states?
Well, I think it's a big barrier that we've had to overcome over the last decade to 15 years is the culture in Michigan. Unlike other states who started becoming more of a knowledge-based economy much earlier than we did, for so long as a manufacturing-based economy, students were able to see their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents graduate high school, find a great job that provided them a middle-class wage without any need for post-secondary education. We've had to overcome that culture, that college is a luxury, not a necessity, because now in Michigan, in our 21st century economy that's largely knowledge-driven, everyone must pursue some education, some formal education beyond high school, whether it's a technical certificate in the skilled trades, an applied associate degree in healthcare, a bachelor's degree, and beyond. We need high school diplomas, just don't cut it anymore.
Ashley, talk to us about your students here a little bit. Is there a story of one student in particular you might be able to share with us that you have helped navigate through this rather daunting application process?
Well, there's a ton, but one that comes to mind is something that happened earlier this year. So one of the grant programs that we deal a lot with is the tuition incentive program, which is tied to being on Medicaid at any point for about 2 years since the age of 9. And so what happens with TIP is one of the many things that happens is that you can go to your local community college, which for us is LCC. You can go there for free for 2 years. And so the student came into my office, and I knew he was eligible because I received a list, and his name was on it. And I asked him, like, what are you planning on doing next year? And he's like, well, Ms. Justice, I really want to go to college, but I can't afford it. My parents don't have the money. Mom is sick. I really want to go and become a mechanic, but I think what I'll do is I'll take a couple years off and save up money and then go back. And we know that students who are low income, if they don't go to college right away.
That scenario concerns you?
Yeah.
Do you agree, Ashley?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's easy to say I'll do it in the future and mm-hmm. it never happens.
They never do.
Yeah.
And so luckily I was able to say, do you know that you're eligible for this program, TIP? He was like, I don't know what that is. So I explained to him what it was and that he can go to LCC for free. And because he's interested in being a mechanic.
Perfect.
That's
yeah.
a two-year program. So he might have to pay for some books, but more than likely, once he fills out the FAFSA, which he has done, the Pell will help pay for books and transportation costs as well. So he can go to college and leave without any debt, and he'll be able, as long as he makes a sacrifice of not making a lot of money, in these next 2 years, he's going to see the payout in the long run and be able to help his family in the long run.
What's the hardest part about your job, Ashley?
Having my kids come in and have these big dreams, and no matter how... and they want to go out of state or they want to go to a four-year college. And even though it's possible, it's something that they can do. They just count themselves out. And no matter how hard I convince them that it will be affordable and that you can do it, sometimes there's other factors that I can't fight against,
mm-hmm.
Like family situations
sure.
or perceived costs of college that they just count themselves out before I can do anything.
Seems like the social landscape here, the family landscape, mm-hmm. has got to be huge. It's mm-hmm. got to be hugely important. Ashley Justice is a college counselor at Waverly High School. I'm also speaking with Brandy Johnson, founder and executive director of the Michigan College Access Network. How do you track MCAN's success rate? Brandy.
Yeah, so we have a dashboard right on our website at micollegeaccess.org. So we track metrics across the spectrum from college aspirations among eighth graders and among parents. We look at ACT scores, college enrollment. We hope that need for remediation rate decreases. But ultimately, we tie ourselves to the big goal, which is attainment. We have set a big goal to have 60% of Michigan adults with a college degree or certificate by the year 2025. Right now, we're at 44%. We have a long ways to go.
Hmm.
The goal was based on labor market demand. In the near term, between 60 and 70% of all jobs in Michigan, not new jobs, all jobs, will require education beyond high school. So only 30% of jobs in Michigan will allow you to have a high school diploma or less as a prerequisite. And those are not well-paying jobs. And so that's what we really rally around is helping more Michigan students, both young and old, get ready for college, actually enroll and pursue, and then complete those valuable credentials.
But is 44% higher than it used to be? I mean, are we at least on an upward trajectory?
Yes. We have had year-over-year increases since 2008, which we used as our baseline. That was actually the first year Census started tracking post-secondary educational attainment. So when we got started, our baseline was 38.4%. We're now at 44%. We've had year-over-year increases, which we're really proud of, but that trajectory just isn't quite steep enough to get us to 60% by 2025. So we really need to accelerate our efforts.
How are you funded?
So we're a public-private partnership. About 50% of our funding comes from the state of Michigan. Governor Snyder and our current legislature have been incredibly supportive of MCAN's work. It is truly a bipartisan issue. Everyone recognizes really the public good of having a more talented workforce, Republicans and Democrats alike. The other 50% of our funds come largely from philanthropic sources. Our friends at the Kresge Foundation, based right here in Michigan, Lumina Foundation, which is an Indianapolis-based foundation, but the largest foundation in the country dedicated solely to higher education. And so we use a mix of funding, again, largely infusing dollars at the local level to invest in great strategies like placing college advisors in high-need high schools.
We've got less than a minute, but I want to ask you about volunteers. Do volunteers play a role in MCAN's mission?
Yeah, especially at the high school level. So as I mentioned, we host a number of campaigns to help seniors make that transition. We host College Application Week in the fall. We host a College Cash campaign, which is a campaign to help students complete the FAFSA. And then right around this time of year, we host College Decision Day, which is based after or modeled after NCAA Signing Day, where student-athletes declare where they're going to college. We want all students to declare loud and proud exactly what they are doing.
Clever idea to base it on the NCAA.
Yeah, exactly. So we have we need volunteers in high schools to help students with applications. We need financial experts, so people like tax preparation experts to help with FAFSAs. And then we need everyone to come out and celebrate Decision Day.
When is Waverly's Decision Day, Ashley?
May 13th.
May 13th, okay. Committed to memory. I've been speaking with Ashley Justice, a college counselor at Waverly High School, and Brandy Johnson, founder and executive director of the Michigan College Access Network. Ashley, Brandy, thank you for joining us, and
thanks,
good
Mark.
Luck to
thank
you.
Thank you.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on WKAR with Michigan's spring and summer tourism season upon us. Current State's Peter Wharf brings us another take on the great outdoors in the Great Lakes State. Grand Rapids authors and historians Christine Byron and Tom Wilson share their passion for Michigan's famed M22 and its many sites. In their book, Vintage Views Along Scenic M22, Chris started off the conversation about the rich roadway.
I think it's one of the most beautiful places in the state. It's got everything. It's got beaches, dunes, of course, Lake Michigan. It's got inland lakes. It's got forests. It's got charming, quaint towns, farms, orchards, wineries, great farm markets. M22 has everything.
I think it means getting off the expressway and being on a road that helps you get in touch with where you are. You know, it takes you back to traveling the way it was in an earlier time.
One of the things that we found the most fascinating about doing the research on this book was that this whole M22 thing is not a new craze. I mean, people were touring the road, back in the early days. D.H. Day, who people would know, from the now National Park, but it originally was the State Park, had promoted M22 as part of the old West Michigan Pike, which was promoted for people to travel all the way from the Indiana border up to Mackinac City. And there were two scenic loops, the M22 and the M119. I thought that was really, very cool that people were promoting the road back then. And there were even three different organizations that were formed over the years to specifically promote M22 to get people to get off the expressway, and travel the scenic road.
Mm-hmm. This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Chris Byron and Tom Wilson, co-authors of the book Vintage Views Along Scenic M-22, including Sleeping Bear Dunes. There are hundreds and hundreds of photos and old advertisements and picture postcards, and you know, you could curl up with this and spend a whole day or a weekend with this fantastic book. But I'm wondering if we can touch on just a few places to get a flavor of the M-22 experience. I'm looking at page 33, Chris and Tom, and a description of Arcadia. It's called The Ideal Vacation Spot by Manistee Vacation Guide, 1939. So we're down in Manistee County now towards the southwestern part of M-22. And the Manistee Vacation Guide says, I'll read a bit of it, Arcadia in the extreme northwestern part of Manistee County is ideally located for the vacationist who wishes to combine the pleasures of Lake Michigan with small lake accommodations and forest enjoyment. And down towards the end it says, Arcadia is surrounded by woods, some of it virgin timber, and the many quiet drives through its green hills and valleys offered to the tired city dweller rest and relaxation from the cares and troubles of a busy world. Wildlife here is abundant, be it birds or deer. And Tom, I think that's maybe a little bit of what you were referring to.
Yes, Arcadia is sort of the opening spot where it's like the window into all the beauty that you're going to see as you travel further north along M-22. I always look at it that way.
Right. I was driving up that way to Manistee Forest a couple of weeks ago, and I really like seeing the old cabin communities, the old groups of cabins that are still there. In places like in Benzie County, Benson's Lakeland Cabins and Modern Rooms near Lake Michigan, Bathing Beach, and Ann Arbor Boat Dock. And then you have a photo of these really clean, cute, tiny white cabins all clustered together under the forest on the hill.
And those are still there.
Yeah, many of them are.
It is now called the Wayfarer. And those cabins are still there. They're painted yellow now, but they're just darling.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Chris Byron and Tom Wilson, co-authors of the book Vintage Views Along Scenic M-22, including Sleeping Bear Dunes. You devote maybe the single largest portion of the book, of course, to Sleeping Bear Dunes. Everything from people skiing on the dunes, on the sand of the dunes in the warm weather, to its characteristic of being a photographer's wonderland, to something that really surprised me, a notice for the second annual Midwest Glider Meet.
Of course, you know, they still have gliders out of Frankfort, and this was the beginning of that tradition in the dunes area. Was the glider meet in Empire, and it was also the beginning of the dune rides, because the modified 1932 Fords that they used to pull the gliders along the beach to get them up in the air were the vehicles that they then took out on the dunes and became the Dunesmobile.
I am Michigan. I am waves along an endless shore. I am Michigan. Where great lakes stretch forevermore and rivers flow and rivers fall. Memories beckon one and all to Michigan.
What were some of the bigger surprises that you came across in researching the book?
One of my favorite things was an attraction like the St. Ignace Mystery Spot. This was called
Glen Magic,
and that is on page 159. And we never knew all the times we've driven along M-22 that there used to be a mystifying forces of gravity place, you know, where you lost all sense of gravity and you could, you know, walk on the walls instead of the floor. And I thought that was a real fun thing. And it didn't last very long. We did talk to some local people that remember it. But I thought that was a fun surprise. And that was an indication, too, of how many people toured M22.
You know, because Traverse City and Leelanau County, they're not on a natural flow to anywhere. They're sort of tucked off in a corner. So it really, you know, it takes some promotion, and I think DHD knew that, to get people up to that area. But once you get there, it's certainly worth the effort.
It's full of beautiful and classic imagery and rich and deep stories. And it's a living history. Vintage views along scenic M22, including Sleeping Bear Dunes, by Christine Byron and Tom Wilson. Chris and Tom, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Speaking of rainbows, they're so close to heaven.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, the Lansing Board of Water and Light was recently the subject of a cyber attack. The utility locked down corporate systems while fighting off the malware. Customer and employee data were not breached. But how were operations and services affected, and what's next? We'll talk with Board of Water and Light General Manager Dick Peffley. Plus, Cinderella leaps onto the stage with the Children's Ballet Theater of Lansing this weekend. We'll speak with the Okemos High School senior filling those shoes. That and more Thursday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed the program today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're on social media. Twitter, at KAR Current State. Facebook, Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day, and we'll see you tomorrow on Current State.